All right, I want to start with a review and a finish up from last time, because I realized last time I just ended when I saw the guys in the hall and I didn't actually finish what I wanted to say. So I want to start just quickly to say that the series is going to be, it's a Shalom Bayit series, but we're basing it on the four letters of the word Shalom. The first class was on the letter Shin, which is perspective. So we're going to revisit that, and today is Lamed, which is accommodation. So you can listen to the tape from last week if you want to hear the vort on that. But let's just start with the Shin for perspective. So last week what I did was I tried to give perspective on marriage. What is a Jewish marriage, and what is the goal of Jewish marriage? But there's also the perspective that we bring to each situation. So I just wanted to tell a story first. I think that I read it in Yehuda Samet's book, but I'm not sure, and the other side of the story. So there's a morning minyan. Every day somebody runs in at the last minute. He throws on his talis, he says Kaddish, and he's out before the end of the minyan. He doesn't even fold up his talis, and somebody is so ticked off. They're like watching him every day, can't even come on time. Day after day, it's so ridiculous. He runs in for the last few minutes. He's just ticked off. So one day he's folding up his talis and somebody else comes over to him and says, can you believe Shmuley? Isn't that amazing how he comes in for Kaddish at the end? He's like, yeah, I can't believe it. It's really something, isn't it? He says, yeah, with his wife being so sick like that he makes time every day to leave her alone for a few minutes to run in just so he can say Kaddish and run out. So it totally can change the entire situation, the exact same situation, depending on the perspective that you have. So we talked about the shin, how it has a dot on either side, which means that you should have one eye open or the other eye. But it does mean that you should be careful about the perspective that you have and increasing perspective. So that's something that we'll go into today. But what I wanted to finish off for last time also, and I want to put into each class, is how what we learned affects our sexual relationship as well. So last class we talked about the concept of shalom and what Jewish marriage is about, and the concept of perspective and free will and what we're trying to accomplish. So I wanted to just say that the beginning of the sexual relationship is about creating shalom. So we talked about how a man and a woman were initially created, how woman was separated from man, but that the sexual relationship is the manifestation of everything that we're talking about. That is how the couple creates one flesh. So we are created as one, then divided into two. Body was divided into two, soul was divided into two, and the whole work of marriage is to knit those two halves back together, so to speak. So I had a good friend, Sara Leah Brazil, Leah Hashalom, who knitted a lot. And she said she found knitting a very spiritual effort because each stitch depends on the last and lays the foundation for the next. And that's really how our lives are and how our lives are created, that each decision that we make depends on the last and lays the foundation for the next. And it's the accumulation of all those decisions, each one, that creates the whole of who we are. So as we work on knitting our souls together, the place where we practice that the most, the place where that's manifest the most, is in the sexual relationship. Really, this is on tape, but you could think of all of our lives in a way as foreplay. Really, everything lays the foundation, especially for women. My aunt wrote a book, I didn't read it, but the title is instructive. You'll see the title. So it's called Men Are Waffles and Women Are Spaghetti. And it talks about how men compartmentalize information like waffles. There's like little squares and they're all separate from each other. And women are like spaghetti. Everything connects to everything else. There is no separate. So particularly for women, and that's something that men need to understand, particularly for women, all of life does lead up to the bedroom and is culminated in the bedroom, and then everything flows from there. So when we talk about creating shalom, shleimut, wholeness or oneness, it really starts and ends in the bedroom. So our home is like our mikdash ma'at, our small mikdash, and we've had all the greater mikdashes of Jewish life have been destroyed. We don't have the Mishkan, we don't have the first Beit HaMikdash, we don't have the second Beit HaMikdash, but the mikdash ma'at of the Jewish home is a permanent mikdash, and that will never be destroyed. We could choose to destroy our own, or we could choose to build our own, but the concept of that being a mikdash ma'at is a permanent concept. So, and the kadosh kadoshim is our bedroom. And it's not lightly compared to that. The Kadosh Kadoshim of the Beit HaMikdash is called the Chadar HaMitot, the bedroom of the Beit HaMikdash, because the bedroom is the place of ultimate connection. The Kruvim, on top of the Aron, you know what the Kruvim are? The cherubs, right? Mm-hmm. So they were hammered out of one piece of gold. And they faced each other when God was happy with the Jews, and they turned away from each other when God was unhappy with the Jews, when we were out of sync. But really, the deeper sources tell us that they were actually coupling when God was happy with us, or had their backs turned to each other when we were out of sync with God. So it really is a place of ultimate privacy, but of ultimate coupling, and it's through that space that the Shekhinah is brought into the world, through the concept of Shalom. So Shalom is one of God's names. It's a name that we can say. We don't say Shakom or something like that, like we do with other names of God, but it is enough of a name of God that we don't say it in a bathroom. But the Shalom, the concept of Shleimut, is what brings the Shekhinah into the world. So when a couple unifies using their bodies, we talked about what a mitzvah is. A mitzvah is the physical pathway to achieve a spiritual connection. So the mitzvah of ona, the mitzvah of marital connection, which is a mitzvah, is the mitzvah of using a physical body to create that spiritual knitting together of the soul. That's what's happening, is that ultimate bonding experience. So when we create the shleimut in that relationship, creating the one, we actually draw down the Shekhinah into the world, and it's through that channel that the Shekhinah is spread to the rest of the world. So it not only creates shalom in our families, shalom in the couple, but shalom in the rest of the world, when we create shalom with our husbands. So it's something that's very important to do often, because it brings a lot of shalom.
Are husbands taught the same thing, that it's important that they create shalom with us?
I hope so. I haven't really talked to Rabbi Meyer about the exact.
I'm just asking because, you know, it's like, for the sake of shalom bayit X, and I call the rabbi a lot. Mm-hmm. Ask him, you know, which trumps this, shalom bayit or chesed, or shalom bayit or this. So it's always like shalom bayit, you know, trust, but I'm the one making the call.
Right.
So I'm curious.
Right. Right. Yeah. So the men hopefully are hearing that, and if they're not, then you need to make an appointment with the rabbi and sit down together. The woman does, so here's part of it. So the woman is the internal energy. We're going to talk about that a little bit more in class Vav, about being on the scene and off the scene. But she is the energy that drives the couple, is the feminine energy. So you may be the one to make the call, but it doesn't mean that he shouldn't be learning that information as well. So it is very important. So we're going to talk about communication a little bit today. It's very important to communicate it and really talk about what are your goals. So that's why, and I'm not going to ask you about the homework, but that's why the homework for last week. Yeah. Lucky. Okay, homework. Spousal discussion and a private meditation. What are the goals of your partnership? What are your goals? What can you achieve with him that you cannot accomplish without him? What will you use your partnership for? So it is important to sit down with your spouse and really talk about, what are your goals? What have you learned in the other class? What are the ultimate goals of marriage that are generic to all marriages? And what are the goals of our marriage? To be on the same page and to discuss that. So that brings us to this class. Pardon?
So we don't know if they're taught the same.
They should be taught the same thing. If they're not, it's an empty space in their education. Now, let me just say, for those of you who had Kala instruction and for those of you who didn't, there's good, there's medium, and there's bad. And there's destructive, and there's superlative Kala education. And some people get two types because they'll go again. But the basic type that's out there now is, I'd say, acceptable plus. There's not as much, there still is some destructive education. There's, for chassans, there's basically destructive, acceptable, and good. And there's not really the excellent and superlative for most chassans. So, and most husbands, certainly of the 20 plus set in this room, 20 years married plus, which is about a third of this group, didn't get any education at all. So, because it just wasn't a thing. They got, if they were part of the firm world at the time, there was a chassan shmooze. That was one class, and it was just about basically how to start the first night and what to expect. But it wasn't halacha, and it wasn't too much hashkafa, and it wasn't shalom bayit, and it wasn't communication. 20 years ago, that's not what the guys were learning. So it is what guys are learning today, young chassans, but it's not what they learned in the past. So it's not that they shouldn't have, it's just that it wasn't. So there has been a breakdown in transmission, basically, of all of these concepts, which is why we're having classes like this. But if you think about it, I was just thinking the other day, isn't it great that our Kala classes are so much better than they used to be? Did I say this in this class? And I was thinking, actually, it's horrible that we have Kala classes like we do today, because what it means is that I'll take my daughter and send her to a stranger to learn about the most fundamentally important aspect of her entire life. How terrible is that? That we have this universal breakdown of communication between mothers and daughters, where we as an entire generation can't educate or discuss with our daughters these fundamental principles. My daughter's here. I talked to her about it. But, so on the one hand, it's tragic that we have to have, in my opinion, it's tragic that we need Kala teachers. And on the other hand, now that we do, thankfully, the level of Kala education is improving. But there is still a lot of mistakes and a lot of reticence. I mean, and a lot of miscommunication because of reticence. So, and you hear that kind of thing going on too. There was a couple who I was aware of who was having a very difficult time. She was experiencing a lot of pain every time. And so they went to the rabbi and discussed it. And the rabbi counseled them to try going in from behind. So they both thought to themselves, they're not really interested in anal sex. Mm-hmm. That just is too weird. So it took 3 years before, in their own experimenting, that they realized that regular vaginal sex going in from behind is much more comfortable for them, and that that must be what the rabbi meant. Because he didn't say what he meant. He said going in from behind. But he didn't want to use the names of body parts in counseling them. So that happens a lot, those kinds of miscommunications where it's not exactly mentioned.
So how does a marriage, when both the man and the wife are being educated to some extent, how is a marriage supposed to start off on the right foot when there's a disconnect between her education and his?
That's an excellent question, and I think we're seeing a lot of problems because of that today. We're seeing a lot of marriages that are not starting off on the right foot, or they don't even, and often the couples don't even realize that it didn't start off on the right foot. And it's not till years later when they realize that the seeds weren't planted correctly, and now they're seeing fruits of ill-planted seeds, so to speak, that they understand there's problems. So, unfortunately, there's repair work that needs to be done. So, it really is a problem, and I think it is important to start, for those of us who have kids in educable years, I think it's important to start from a very young age, thinking about how we're going to educate for tznius, which is not just how you dress, but for tznius, and then for privacy, and then for sexuality. All of that starts at 3, 7, 10, 12, 14, 18, and then before they get married, you get even more explicit, but especially today. You need to be discussing it with your kids, boys and girls, from a young age. First of all, so that they know you're honest with them. Second of all, so that you're planting ideas. Third of all, so that they can know they can come to you and ask anything, and you will tell them. They can't ask you what you do, but they can ask you theoretically. So they know they have somebody they can turn to who will be honest with them or help them find answers. They know they have somebody they can trust, and that relationship starts very young. Boys, too, it's not too late. So... I'll just tell you, I mean, right, on Facebook, send a message, don't post it on the wall, right? But when my 12-year-old came home and said to me, boy, and said to me, Emo, what's oral sex? I said, well, let's just sit in the other room and we'll talk about it for a minute. So I said, you know what sex is, right? He said, yeah. I said, well, oral means mouth. He said, oh. Then we talked for an hour. So. Right. But it is important to have a rapport with a child where you can talk about it and be honest about it and discuss concepts and be armed with concepts so that you can share with them, because they might not get the information that they need. Boys are still catching up to the female education. It is behind in many ways. So the parents need to be there. It really is the parents' responsibility to educate. And the Kala teacher, the Chasson teacher, is the parents' assistant, not the parents' replacement. So I think that's important to understand, that the parents need to be there. Yes, Kala teachers of training.
I was just going to say that I think that's so interesting, because I think that when I talk to a lot of, not Paul Chulas, but I would say more FFBs that it's not how, it's like you don't talk about it.
Right.
Like, there's this whole thing about the mikvah, who gets to come to the Torah and who doesn't get to go to the Torah.
Right.
Do the Beit Yaakov girls go or do they not go? I mean, it was like this huge thing.
Right.
And it's like a taboo
right.
subject.
It is a taboo
and
subject.
I wasn't brought up that way,
right.
And it's so against me as a person to not talk
so
about it.
So here's the thing. As Jews, let's just picture us back at Sinai, right? We all received the Torah together, all observing it 100%. And then we pass it down to our children pretty pure. We're in the desert 40 years, learning it from Hashem, going to the land of Israel. Land of Israel, very nice, Beit HaMikdash. Then we get conquered, second conquering. And now, as this group, we travel through history, going into many different societies. And as we go into those societies, we absorb things from those societies, which you can see by looking at all of us. There's facial features, there's cooking tastes, there's clothing tastes, there's a musical features, and there's ideas. We have absorbed ideas. So you can't say even Torah true Jews who are from forever, which is my new distinction, you have FFBs, which Elisheva is, but she's not an FFF, right? Because she wasn't born to an FFB. So, right? Suri Meyer is an FFF and Elisheva is an FFB. So even... it's very confusing, right? But so even for the FFFs or even for somebody who was brought up speaking Yiddish so that they shouldn't speak English, that's one of the reasons why they have Yiddish-speaking communities, so they should not be able to absorb. And still, we have absorbed. Even if you don't have media in your home. So one of the things that we have absorbed that's pretty significant is Christian prudishness about sex. It doesn't mean that it's not Jewish to stand here and talk about it to a room. However, we have broken down as a society to the place where now it's necessary. There are so many misconceptions and so little information out there, and especially in a group of mostly Baal Yeshiva where we didn't get the proper education, and even if we got the Kala classes, and even if we became Kala teachers, what does that mean? 16 total sessions of education? It doesn't mean years, and it doesn't mean generations of education. So that has to be changed, and it has to be made up for. So it is very different. Now, so that's certainly for Baalei Tshuva, but even for from birth, we have absorbed Christian prudishkeit, and it's not like my combination of words.
Here's like, I mean, with the girls, I was with my niece this weekend. She's 15, and she has Our Bodies Ourselves on her table in her bedroom, and I'm like, Mom, where'd you get it? Mom gave it to me, my sister. I mean, I had it. You know, that was mm-hmm. my book. I don't know if you know, from Our Bodies Ourselves. It was mm-hmm. like a critical, pivotal 70s. Thing for women
right.
in the 70s to have access to a book that discussed every aspect of our
right.
bodies.
Right.
So, does the From World have a book? Or
there is one, and it's really bad.
What book?
It's, I have it. I can show it to you. It's really bad.
Do you mean The Wonder of Becoming You?
Yes.
Okay, so The Wonder of Becoming You... That's for fourth or fifth graders. That's only for educating girls about what's happening to their bodies. They go into menstruation and how to take care of it.
Right.
That's all it's for. I think it's sweet too. Does not discuss sexuality. It's not meant to discuss that. It's not meant to discuss.
What?
So is there something, Treif, about suggesting that these girls should have Our Bodies Ourselves?
So Our Bodies Ourselves for FFBs is not the appropriate book. It doesn't mean it's not appropriate after a girl gets married, after a woman gets married. She's a girl before, she's a woman after. So after that same 21-year-old comes out from under the chuppah, I think it's appropriate for her to have that book. Maybe give her a month first. There's a huge transformation that happens over that first month.
Wedding presents.
Right.
A month later, you know who's from.
But it's a month later, yeah.
A year later, you know
right. But it's not for right away. So we do have selective disclosure in terms of sexuality. And certainly in raising from girls, and this is different from being the Baal Tshuva, but those of us who are raising girls, we do have this project of repression that we're all party to, and that is part of the from way. It's part of protection. So I'm calling it cynically repression, but that's what it is. I mean, the no media, the no non-Jewish music at all, the limiting of Jewish music with any kind of a beat, so a girl shouldn't move too much to a beat. Chevra, out. If you're in Beis Yaakov, you know, Yehuda, in. So...
Don't let Rabbi
Right.
Right. So, but why is that? I mean, part of that is just about keeping that whole program going where girls are protected from being in touch with sensuality and certainly from sexuality until they're ready to get married, until they are married. And we give them limited teaching before the wedding, just what they need to know. I really think there needs to be college classes after that. I mean, it really should be a one-year program. It's a mistake to drop a girl off. And right, even though...
You have no idea where you're even
pregnant.
Right.
You have a baby.
Right.
I mean, so, right. You don't
right.
touch on any of that stuff.
Right. Right. So that definitely needs... We definitely need a year-long program of education.
Right.
Yeah, so there's a real curriculum that a mother could use or that a teacher could use, but it needs to exist. So there's a project as we all grow together. Somebody could write that curriculum. But that is an important thing. So, but back to us then, and back to our husbands. There are things to read for husbands, and I think it would pay to read together certain things. I'm rereading for this class an old classic that I really like, which is Eliyahu Kitov's A Jew in His Home. It was written in the 50s. So A Jew in His Home, or A Jew and His Home, Eli Ish Uveito. It is a classic, and it's the standard. In Israel, it's still given to every couple by the Rabbanut when they get married.
By whom?
By Eliyahu Kitov. He's the one who wrote Book of Our Heritage, if anybody's used that book. Which is a very helpful book, right? It has. I've used that book since my very beginning. It has beginner's information, and every time I open it, I learn something new. Every single time. Mm-hmm. So, pardon? Yeah, right. So, he's a good author, and I'm just it has some a little bit older fashioned information or ways of presenting, but it does have good basic information in terms of Shalom Bayit education and foundations of a Jewish home. It's an excellent place to look, and if you want to re-educate yourself or kind of time travel back to the beginning of your marriage, back to when Jewish families were more intact, so both. I think it might be something nice to just read out loud back and forth with a husband and just say, how do we feel about this? What does this look like if we want to read? And sometimes you'll run up against something that doesn't jive with how you feel about what marriage should look like. And it's important at those times to use that to explore what's the difference between the way I feel and the Jewish concept of marriage. Because sometimes we do feel differently about marriage than what the actual Jewish concept is. So I'll give you a for instance of that, something that I learned in this, which I found very helpful. So there is a Gemara. So he talks about divorce, why the laws of divorce are written before the laws of marriage, and that divorce is something that actually strengthens the Jewish marriage. And in the Ketubah, you might think, how strange is that? You're standing under the chuppah, you're either in love or you hope to be in love, but you are sealing your lives together. And under that, you're talking about, if you get divorced, how much money do you get? Right? You're writing it right into the contract. In the case of divorce, this is what will happen. So why should that be in the very beginning? Why do we write the laws of divorce first? So he says that the laws of divorce strengthen Jewish marriages. Unlike other cultures that have tried to outfirm Judaism and make marriage eternal and unbreakable, divorce is actually very important and central to the Jewish marriage. So I'll give you an illustration, and then I'll tell you why. So my husband, when he was 16, worked in a liquor warehouse. His father was a vice president of Seagram's at the time. He got a job shoving boxes onto a truck with a bunch of Italian guys who were shoving boxes onto the truck. So they're talking about marriage, and somebody's saying how they're engaged. They fell in love with this girl, get engaged. And one of the guys says, oh, what are you going to marry for love for? Betty, you should marry one of your father's paisano's daughters. First you love her, then she loves you, then you don't love her, then she don't love you, and then you have to get a gun or a divorce or something. So if you're a Catholic, you have to get a gun
right.
or a divorce or something. But if marriage is permanent, so a gun is the first answer and divorce is second, right? Because that's how you get out of it, is if somebody dies. So in Judaism, divorce is a possibility. So now, we'll learn a Gemara without the names of it and without the source, because I don't have either one of those. Three rabbis discussing divorce. So, you can get divorced. Rabbi one says you can get divorced only if you can prove sexual infidelity. Rabbi number two says you can get divorced if she burns your food. Rabbi number three says you can get divorced if somebody else is more attractive to you than her. So this Gemara has been highly misunderstood. Everybody's taking offense right now, but let's explain it from the Gemara way. When you have a machloket in Gemara, what it means is that you're arguing about the details, but the central principle is agreed upon. For instance, when you're arguing about how much the wedding ring has to be worth, what's the maximum amount or minimum amount that it can be worth, so everybody agrees that there has to be a transference of something of value. That's agreed upon. Now the question is just how much is the value? So in this situation, everybody agrees divorce is something that we have and we allow. Now the question is, for what reason? So reason number one, very serious, only in the case of a total breach of all fidelity. And the other two rabbis say, no, that's not the case. If things aren't working well, which is symbolized by burning the food, if things aren't working well, you can get divorced from that too. Oh, but what if things are working well, but you just lose your taste for her? So rabbi number three says, if you don't have a taste for her anymore, that also, which means divorce is completely kosher. Not that you should get divorced for any of those reasons, but that you can. Now, the reason why you can is to ensure, and here's where it's really important how divorce strengthens Jewish marriages, to ensure that your marriage is always free will. It's always based on free will. You can exit it for any reason. Whenever you feel like it, you're out, which means that every day that you're in is because you've chosen it. Because you want it. Because you're willing. Also, lightening it up, making it easy to get a divorce, or lowering the bar to the very lowest level of why you could get a divorce means you could always get it. So today you're frustrated. Tomorrow you could get it too. So wait an extra day. See if you want it tomorrow before you get it today. You know, it's available to you. So see if you can work things out. Wait a day, wait a week, wait a month, wait a year. See if you can make it work. If you can't make it work, so you can't. But making it forbidden makes you feel like you're entering into a trap and you're living in a prison and you can't get out. So having divorce as a concept lightens it up and means every day you stay is because you want to stay.
Is that in America? Because in Israel we have the agunot that are trapped for...
Okay, so now agunot is a significant problem today only because of the breakdown of the Jewish community. So let me explain. So divorce, the ketubah is a contract that the man signs, his promises to her. He gives it to her, only he can revoke it. That's what affects the marriage. So he's the only one who can give a get. Let's say that if she wants to initiate divorce proceedings, she has to go to a Beit Din and get the Beit Din to get him to want to give the get.
If he doesn't want, they're stuck.
It used to be pretty easy to make him want. And in Israel, it's easier than it is in America. Because in America, one of the ways that we make guys want to get is we understand that deep inside, every man wants to do the right thing. Sometimes he has enough crust on the outside that he's not sure what the right thing is. So if we beat him hard, we'll get the crust off, and then he'll want to do the right thing. So one thing that we do Jewishly, with a man who does not want to give a get, who should, is we abduct him and beat him until he says, I want to. We can't do that in America.
In
Jewish communities, in shtetl life, until about 150 years ago, when we had Jewish society that was intact, where law was run by Beit Din, where that's where people turned, and it was relative, I mean, there's always been corruptions, but with an intact Jewish society, that was an option. Another option was ostracizing him. Nobody does business with him, nobody will give him an aliyah, nobody will talk to him, nobody will even be social at all. He can't go to the mikvah, he can't buy groceries. There's no other place for him to go. There was no transportation. And where are you going to go when the whole community is ostracizing you? And all you have to do if you go to the next community is send a letter to the rabbi there and he's out. We can't...
Can't they prevent this whole thing with a prenuptial before they get married?
Oh, so that's a very complicated thing. Let me just finish the sentence and then I'll address that. So today, with the breakdown in Jewish society, where we don't respect rabbis and we don't respect each other and we don't have congregations that function as a unit, we can't do that. Because ostracize somebody from Aish and they can go to Eidos, you know, or wherever they want, or they can go to Phoenix, you know, and even if you make a phone call, so they don't really know the circumstances, you know, and like, oh, so whatever, he's in Phoenix and he's fine. So can't we fix that problem with a prenuptial agreement? So the problem with a prenuptial agreement, and there are some that are effective and there are some that are not. So apparently, according to Jewish law, if you give a get forced, it's not a good get. So some of the prenuptial agreements say if you want to have a civil divorce, you must give a get. If you do that, then in a way that's forcing it, and it could make the get ineffective always because it's forced, and then she's really stuck because you can't even give it to her, really. So it has to be a properly structured one, and they are working on creating ones that are properly structured so that they are in accordance with halacha, and more couples are doing that before they get married. Because it is an important thing just to structure in a way that a woman has recourse that's effective recourse. So that's unfortunate that that's necessary. It has been recognized as necessary, and rabbis are working on structuring that in the beginning of marriages today. So
the man doesn't need the woman to agree. He wants a get, he gets a get. But
she does have to agree. She has to accept it. So it's a problem. If she doesn't accept it, he can't get divorced.
Either?
No, he can't. So I know of one situation where the woman, in this particular case, the woman was abusing the man. He wanted to get divorced. She wouldn't accept the get because that was part of her abuse. So he deposited the get with the Beit Din so that she could accept it at any time, but it was a few years and she wouldn't accept it. He wanted to get remarried, but we don't have polygamy today. So how's he going to get remarried? Technically, a man can have more than one wife. So there's a thing called a heter mea rabbanim, a 100 rabbi permission slip. So if you deposit your get with the Beit Din, and if you explain to 100 rabbis what you've done, and they all sign off, yes, you've done your best, and it's not possible for you to effect the divorce, 100 rabbis together can allow you to marry a second wife. So there's that recourse for the abused husband. It doesn't exist for the chained wife. So in Israel, what they do is they imprison. But there are some men, so this will bring us back to our topic of today. There are some men whose goal is so large that they are willing to suffer imprisonment for it. Their goal is to torture their wife. And they're willing to go to jail for years to be able to do that. So that all you can do is imprison them or beat them. But if they're willing to take the beatings and the imprisonment and still not give a get, she's stuck. So it really depends on what your goal is and what kind of a commitment you're willing to make to achieve your goal. So there are a few wives whose husbands have made very serious commitments to their suffering. And they can achieve the suffering by keeping that commitment. So let's come back to where we are here in Lamed. So I hope I have the similar sheet to you. Okay, I'm sure all of you have heard the Devar Torah, but I just want to repeat about Ish and Isha, right? Just making sure that you've all heard. Isha is spelled Aleph Shin Hey. Can I write that down? No. Aleph Shin Hey, and Ish is spelled Aleph Yud Shin. The letters in common are Ish. Man and women both have fire in them. The fire, though, can get out of hand. Thank you very much. When combined, so the fire can be passion, which is an important passion, but passion can burn both directions. So passion can burn to warm and to grow, and passion can burn to destroy. So that's why in each name, half of the name of God is placed, the yud in the man's name and the hey in the woman's name. I don't need to write down, right? Because everybody can picture that. And so when the couple comes together, if they create a place of shalom, if they create shalom between them, then that allows God's presence to dwell in them, and the fire then becomes a constructive fire rather than a destructive fire. So the question is, how do we create that shalom? So that's where the Lamed comes in. That's where today's class is. Yikes. Okay, so the Lamed can stand straight up or it can bend way over backwards. So let's just go through this thing. So shalom, then, is both the goal of what we're trying to create ultimately, shleimut, oneness, but it's also the means to the goal. So last time we talked about the difference between goals and means, but setting the goal, the larger goal of shalom, requires a smaller goal of having the means of shalom. So there is, in a way, a fake it till you make it strategy here. You want to ultimately create shleimut. But in order to create shlemut, there has to be shalom in your home. So how do you create that shalom? So the first thing is to understand, so the first thing I put on here is a willingness to change. Everybody has to understand that getting married, having a successful marriage, means that you have to be willing to change. Not just when you get married, but particularly that's important to understand in the beginning of a marriage so that the marriage will start off correctly. You both have to change. Period. End of discussion. So the question is, how will you be changing and where? But you both have to change. And it's a continual process. Don't think because you're married for 20 years or 30 years that change is done, that you both changed enough. So I'll tell you one of the things one of the compromises that we made that I think about actually on a almost daily basis, you'll hear why, is something that is an affirmation of our shalom. So I believe the toilet paper should have the thing coming over. He believes it should go under. There was no agreement on this, so we agreed that however it came out of the package when we opened it up, that's how we would put it on the roll. We wouldn't check. So, still today, 23 years later, every time I open it, I just put it on without checking. And then I see if it came out the right way or the wrong way. But I didn't give up my opinion of what's right or wrong, but I was willing to change how I did things, not check, and put it on however it came out. So whether it's paper towel or toilet paper or however it comes out of the package, that's how it goes on the roll. So, but every time I do that...
How do you like it?
I like it with the paper coming over. He likes it with the paper going under. It does make a big difference. Right. So because we made that agreement, though, in the beginning... In private, totally. He would never know if I checked. But I know. So I know that I'm affirming the strength of our relationship and our connection every time I put a roll of toilet paper on the thing. Because we made an agreement, and I keep it. So willingness to change.
I don't know what you mean by under, so bring the toilet paper next time. Oh. This will be over. All right.
Anyway, okay, so in order to be married, you have to change. The only person you can change, however, is yourself. Everybody knows that, right? Or everybody should know that. Newlyweds, it takes a little time to learn that, but you can never change your husband. You can, however, change your interaction by changing yourself. And when you change your interaction, it will most likely have the effect of changing them. So if you think about, first we start out as a couple, so think about a mobile hanging from a string. It has one branch and then two things hanging from it. You can't tap one side without the other side moving. It's not possible. So if you tap yourself, you will cause that system to shift. As you add children to the system gets more complicated. Each person as they move shifts the entire system. So when a child is born with special needs, when a child gets accepted to Harvard, when a husband loses a job, when a wife finds a job, when whatever it is, when somebody makes a decision to work on their anger, to not speak Lashon Hara, whatever it is, that shifts the system in some way. The only person you can change is you. But you can change the way the system functions by changing yourself. And that will probably, not always, shift the way the other person relates, because then you've changed the space in which that person can relate by changing yourself. But it has to be focused on changing self. You can't change somebody else. So in order for changes to happen and accommodation to happen, there is a prerequisite. So that prerequisite is sensitivity and perception. We do have to be able to perceive what the other person needs. So some of that comes from communication. Sometimes there's effective communication and sometimes ineffective communication. So you want to start with making fewer assumptions. So certainly for newlyweds, you start with fewer assumptions. Like, for instance, vocabulary words. Now this is hard because sometimes it's so clear to you what the word means that you would never think to ask. So, for instance, I don't think I gave this example. Did I give you the example of a malava malka last week? So a couple is newly married, and the husband comes home after Shabbos, 2-3 months later, and says, oh, I invited my brother, Yaakov, for Malava Malka. 2 months later, his wife's crying in the bedroom. And he goes in and says, what's the matter? I don't have food, and I didn't prepare, and the house is not separate. I don't know what to do. How come you didn't tell me? And it's just not right, and you invited him over. And he said, what? We're going to have, like, leftover gefilte fish, a piece of challah, and a cup of tea. Like, so in her house, a malava malka is an affair. They don't do it every week. That's when her mother invites guests and sets the table and puts out another meal, and it's like lunch, right? It's a big deal. In his house, malav malka is a mitzvah that they keep every week, where they have something hot that was cooked Motzei Shabbos, and they wash. If they add something into that, great. If not, not. But a piece of challah and a cup of tea counts as something cooked and some washing, and that's it. So it was a total, it was only because they had misperceptions of the same word that,
Can I just ask a question about this now?
Yeah.
We're all, this is a meal of Shabbos or not a meal?
No, it's after Shabbos. So
I know it's after Shabbos, but
it's an important mitzvah to have a malav malka. It's important enough that it has its entire own perek in the Shulchan Aruch. And the perek, the whole thing is, you should have a malav malka after Shabbos, as close to Shabbos as possible, because you are escorting the queen out.
After Havdalah.
After Havdalah. So basically, we do a lot of escorting with food as Jews, right? So we do something to escort the queen out with food. It can happen anytime before you go to sleep, but it's better to do it as close to Havdalah as possible. So it can be dinner in the wintertime. Whatever it is, you just have in mind, it's a malav malka. In the summertime when you have Tzudash Lishit at 7 and you're really full, so then you can just wash and bench, or you can have a cracker. You can, just like Tzudash Lishit, it's best to wash. Next best is mizonot. Next best is a piece of fruit or shehakol, something that marks the third eating zone. so it is best to, right.
Why is this not ritually observed in some communities?
For the same reason, that many communities, Chabad has its whole own set of minhagim, so I can't comment. But the Shulchan Aruch says we're supposed to. The Shulchan Aruch says a lot of stuff we're supposed to do that we don't, but that we should. Well, no, it's three times on Shabbat, and the fourth is Malav Malka.
Oh, there's no breakfast.
No, well, Friday night, Shabbos lunch, right, breakfast doesn't count. You can have breakfast if you want, but that's not one of the three meals. Right, depending on how you hold. But whatever, yeah, so a lot of people have breakfast. Some
to die, it's impossible.
To die, well, you can have less. You do not have to eat a lot. Nobody says you have to set the fullest table full of everything that we set. And could be with this financial setback, that's a good time for all of us to go on diets and just serve less. That's a possibility. You know, Shabbos lunch used to be chillin. And that was it. It wasn't a side dish. It was the whole thing. So we could consider that occasionally, you know. Fish before, but you don't have to have dessert. No, no, it's best to wash and make a meal, and then whatever you want to add with that. You don't. It's best to wash on bread. And you don't have to have anything else. You can have whatever else you want. But let's say you don't feel like washing, you could have a cracker instead, mizono, or a piece of cake. Let's say you don't want a cracker or a cake, you could have a piece of fruit. If you want it all, you could have it all. But there's levels like that. Same thing with Malav Malka. Okay, back to communication and noticing what people want. So an important story that all of my children have heard, but I'll tell you now. It's very important to communicate what you want. Nobody is a mind reader, including your husband. So when my mother got married, when she got engaged, she got a marquee diamond. The wedding band was, had a little dip in it to accommodate the bottom. And she always thought to herself, when I have my first baby, I want the matching ring for the top, complete the set. So when I was born, and my father came to the hospital with no ring box in his hand, she was so disappointed. But she realized that she had never told him that that was what she wanted. So of course she wasn't going to get it, because he had no clue that she expected him to go out and buy the third ring for the first baby. So that was her story always to me, say what you want. So it's very important to communicate what you want. And in our personal relationship, we try to communicate what we want, even if the person does go out and buy a gift. So say if you like it or not. First of all, it helps educate the person on the taste. And second of all, why should you be stuck with something you don't want, especially if it's something expensive? If it's a piece of jewelry, it's not your taste, so exchange it. The thought went into it. My husband, for my birthday, got me, my birthday's February 8th, so it's era of Valentine's zone. He got me a huge 3-pound chocolate heart.
Oh,
right, so I'm thinking, that's nice, but can't really wear it. And then Miriam Hoffman came and said, that's nice, but you can't wear it. She said, but actually you can.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought, that is so getting returned. Right back to the store, and I went to TJ Maxx and bought a silver heart instead. To wear it in a different way. So I said, sweetheart, do you mind if I return it? He says, that's fine. You return most of the presents that I get you.
It's very deflating to this male ego to get you things that are always taken back.
Well, so that's why it's important for him, if he really doesn't want to take it back, to learn your taste. That's up to him. And your taste may be eclectic enough that he can't
make it work.
He can't really pin it. You know, so it may be that you go together, or maybe that the best thing is a gift certificate to a store that you like. You know, so that it's something that you like, and that way he thought of it and he got it for you, but you get to pick what the thing is. But it's okay to do that if you want to enjoy the thing. So that depends on your relationship, but honesty there is an important thing. Okay, I see the guys in the hallway, and we're not done. So, okay, well, let him stay for a few minutes, because in terms of the Lamed, there are two very important points that I want to get to today. And that is the concept of Vatranut. Vatranut or Vatranus, depending on how you'd like to pronounce it. Vatranut. I want to just say it in a way that people might recognize it if they've heard it before. Vatranus, Vatranut. Or to be Mevater, Mevateret in our case. So to be Mevater means to let go of something and not get what you want. It's almost more than compromise. It means understanding that your goal is greater than the thing. My relationship with my husband is more important to me than which way the toilet paper roll goes. So I'm mevater on it. It's okay for me not to get what I want part of the time, or sometimes a lot. Like, I used to be a vegetarian. Not that that was that important to me. It was a whole separate story. Or when I came into the marriage, I was a very whole wheat, brown rice kind of granola type of cook. That's not what he was interested in. So I was mevater on that, as you could see. So we're going to now slide back into that. Did the first quarter century his way, and the next one gets to go mine. So
is lamed for a word and shin for a word in Hebrew? Why shin?
Shalom.
Okay.
So lamed is for the shalom. And we're doing each a letter per week.
But she is the word for perspective, not.
Perspective, because it has a dot on one side or a dot on the other side, the eye being looking at it from one direction or looking at it from the other.
And the lamed?
The lamed. So in the lamed, I'm calling that accommodation, because it either stands straight up or it bends over backwards. The lamed is the only letter that can bend over backwards. If there's a letter above it on the line, it will bend over backwards to accommodate a nun sofit that's right above it.
I've never seen that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could see a lamed bent over backwards. So in terms of accommodating then, Vatranut is one of the ways. But what's important to realize in any kind of tension that comes up, if one wins, the other one lost. If you win, you'll then be married to a loser. And nobody wants to be married to a loser. It's really better to create a situation in which you either both win or you both arrive at a solution together as partners. So that rather than seeing him here and your problem in the middle, and you have to figure out how one of you is going to get your piece, better you should bring him next to you and you both look at the problem together and figure out how you're going to tackle this. This is your marriage. This is your life. How do you together want to have perspective on that thing where you're going to make it work together? Because your goal is a greater goal. Your goal is shalom. It doesn't mean that negative things won't come up, and it doesn't mean that there won't be differences of opinions, and it doesn't mean that there won't be disagreements, but it does mean that there's ways to handle it. So we're going to go further into ways to handle it, but I want to at least, I'll skip that part for this week, but controlling anger. So controlling anger is something at least I want to give you guys, one more minute, I want to give you guys as something to think about for this week. So what is your goal? If your goal is shleimut, and in order to accomplish shleimut, you need shalom, you really need to think about the role of anger in your life. Does it ever pay? So I just flew back from, does it ever pay?
Again.
You have to think about the role of anger in your life. The role of anger. If you want to think about what your goals are, what is the role of anger in your life? So I was on the plane today, flying back from New York, and there's a mother holding not quite toddler, but past baby, right? Baby is crying, screaming, right? So, and mom is not a young mom. I heard her tell somebody else, she's 38. Okay, this is baby number one, though. So that means she's had plenty of time to really center on self. She's got the Calvin Klein jeans and the big diamond bracelet and toddler. Okay? So first she's shh, 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 shh. And then she's quiet, stop. Shh, shh. And then she's like, ow, stop, quiet, shh, shh. And she's like, I'm thinking, what is your goal? Your goal is to get the kid to stop crying. Being angry with your kid is not going to help at all. It's just going to delay your goal. Now, it's very easy to see it in that kind of a case, that the anger absolutely gets in the way of her achieving her goal. And why was she angry? She's embarrassed. She's uncomfortable. She would rather do what she wants to do. She wants the kid to fall asleep on her lap so she can read or watch her iPod, right? But that's not happening. So she's getting angry with the child for crying. So clearly the anger is in the way of achieving her goal. So I'm using that example because it's so easy to see, but almost always our anger gets in the way of us achieving our goal. Almost always. Creating shalom is of such paramount importance that all efforts towards it always pay off, unlike every other thing in our life. We can make efforts to dress beautifully, to lose weight, to earn money, to have a large family, to educate our family well. They don't always pay off. But efforts towards creating shalom always pay off. However much effort you put into it, you get that much further towards the process. There's always fruit in any effort you put in towards creating shalom. So controlling your anger is one of the first steps. It's really hard. But anything that's really worth it takes a lot of energy. So think about what we do to earn a living, or what we do to raise a family, or what we do to serve a country. Of course it's hard, but if it's worth it, we're willing to put a lot of work into something. So controlling anger is one of those things that it's worth it to put a lot of effort into. So it is late, and I hear the guys in the hallway, but I don't want to totally end. Yeah, I do want to continue, but let's just do for a second accommodation in the physical relationship before you go, just so that we don't have to start on this next time. So a relationship in the physical, how will you accommodate using accommodation in your physical relationship? So there are accommodations that need to be made depending on your life stage and your interests. So some of the accommodations, and I wrote down here, might be timing, might be frequency, might be change. Sometimes you need to change the way you do things. Sometimes you need to change the time that you do things. Let's say you have a lot of kids and you're really tired. Nighttime might not be the right time. Let's say you have to get up early in the morning to get the kids up. Morning might not be the right time. Maybe in the middle of the night's the right time. Maybe you need to set an alarm so you both get 3 hours of sleep, wake up, enjoy each other, and go back to sleep. So, I mean, you need to sometimes think about creative solutions for how you can make it work, because it is very important to a relationship to have physical intimacy, to have sexual pleasure. It's very important that both partners have sexual pleasure. And it's important to, that's an investment in the relationship. It's a manifestation of how well the relationship's going, but it's also an investment in making the relationship go smoothly. So that's very important. Frequency, that's something that always needs to be rediscussed and negotiated, but I'm sure you probably all saw the Woody Allen movie where there's a split screen and the therapist is asking Woody, so, how many times a week do you have sex? And he says, almost never. And asks Annie Hall, how many times a week do you have sex? She says, almost always. And at the same time, they both say, about 3 times a week. So, So it does need to, that is something that needs to be discussed. And if somebody has, I mean, depending on where you are hormonally, depending on where he is in terms of work, depending on all kinds of different things, that is something that needs to be in actual laid on the table discussion. How can we make it so that we're both taken care of here? So, and if it's, if you're really out of sync, then you need to seek help, rabbinic or therapeutic. But that is, if you're very out of sync and can't figure out how to get it together yourselves, that's a place to definitely, definitely go for help. And if the first person doesn't help, go to somebody else. Not every rabbi can help, and not every therapist is good. So it's important to seek enough help that you're helped and not stop because you went to somebody and they didn't help. Okay, so now we'll do homework. Homework. We'll talk about skip step two next time, but consider your anger policy. Consider profit and loss. What am I trying to achieve here, and how is it served by the way that I'm behaving? You can't always consider that in the moment, although you can train yourself to consider that in the moment. But over the coming week, I would like you just to consider, if you have a policy on anger, what your goal might be and what type of a commitment you're willing to make to achieve your goal. So think about your anger policy and just notice. You don't even have to work on it this week, but the work is noticing anger and thinking about an anger policy this week. Awareness of anger, how it manifests in your life, and if you might consider an anger policy, a commitment towards changing an anger policy. And we'll meet back next week.
Thank you.